dream of me at night.
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
All right, welcome everybody. It's November. It's a new week. We're going to start with something really instructive today. Last week, the week before, I talked about sort of the inherent difficulty of confronting these conspiracy theorists or conspiracy delusionists with the idea of I'm just going to show them how each one of their claims is wrong, and that it's really difficult to do this in real time. I talked about a recent Sam Harris podcast episode where he outlines this very well when he's asked, what about having someone like Brett Weinstein on and arguing with him about each one of his points related to vaccines and ivermectin, et cetera. And Sam Harris very astutely pointed out, it's really easy to start 10 small fires. And if you can only put out 8 or 9 of them, it kind of ends up looking like you didn't really address this elephant in the room. There was a really good post on our subreddit, which mentioned this and has a link to an interview that happened on Friday where Bill Maher interviews Sean Spicer. And this user Reflex Point actually says, Bill Maher versus Sean Spicer and why fact-checking conspiracy theorists in real time is a problem. David was recently mentioning Sam Harris's statement about why it can be dangerous to argue with conspiracy theorists in a live format, because if they just start gish-galloping a bunch of nonsense in real time, it can be difficult to come out of it looking like you won. And Sean Spicer does a perfect example of that when giving his reasons to question election integrity. He'll point to some obscure rule that changed in some battleground state and then claim it's suspect, and Bill is supposed to know about it. And if he doesn't, then Bill must be wrong in having confidence in the election results. So let's take a look. I'm going to play this 2.5 minutes uninterrupted. See if you can keep track of all the different assertions that Sean Spicer makes. I'm keeping track, and then we're going to go through them in a moment.
Yes. What about the election was rigged and Trump really won? Is that lunacy?
I think there are some serious problems with the election.
Here we go.
No, time out. Hold on. What? When you look at Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Nevada,
yes,
the idea that we changed rules running up to an election in terms of how a ballot when it was counted, do you think Pennsylvania, the law signed by a Democratic governor in 2019, Act 77, signed by Governor Wolf, said that all ballots had to be in by 8 p.m.
There was a pandemic. That's why they changed
the law.
There was no time to do that.
There was plenty of time to pass legislation in all of these other areas.
But this is a rabbit hole you want to go down.
I do.
To avoid the question, did Trump win or lose the election?
I don't know.
Well, there you go.
Because here's
the world does.
Tell me how many votes that got cast illegally and not according to the system.
But
who did they go for?
But this was litigated in every court. Even Republicans who were in charge of the vote came down on the side of this election was fairly adjudicated. You yourself said right after the election, they asked you about fraud.
They asked me if
you have said, I have seen no evidence.
Correct. I haven't. But what I have seen is a state. There's a difference.
So imaginary evidence?
No. There is a difference. What Pennsylvania's Supreme Court did, what Wisconsin's clerks did, they let people. Wisconsin does not have a provision in their law to let people vote early in person. It has an absentee ballot provision. People set up tables in parks in Madison, Wisconsin, and allowed people to come without identification. In Pennsylvania, they were allowed to vote without identification, no postmark on the ballot, in violation of Act 77 signed by a Democratic governor in 2019. And the answer is, well, then don't worry about it because it was a pandemic. Well, what's the next thing that you can just blow away? A law is a law until it's changed. You don't get to pick what you want to follow depending on what's happening outside.
Okay, this was looked at exhaustively.
That's not true, though. What was looked at, for example, in Wisconsin, the court ruled 4-3.
Okay, Sean, I get it. You know what?
You accuse me of something.
You said your piece. I haven't looked at this. You're like that kid in school who...
Who's right.
No. who has to answer about the book report, so reads one page very carefully that nobody else read, and then does a thing on that, and then we don't know what you're talking about.
You do.
But we know that what I do know...
Okay, so that's a lot. So think about all of the different things that Bill Maher, in principle or in theory, had to be ready to refute and how difficult it is. Now, we've done it after the fact, but just look at how much time this is going to take me. So Sean Spicer mentions Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Nevada, and says they changed rules leading up to an election. He mentions a 2019 Pennsylvania law signed by Governor Wolf that says ballots have to be in by 8 p.m. on election day. He's asked, did Trump win or lose? He doesn't know because he doesn't know the results in different states. He asks how many votes were illegally cast. He says the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and the Wisconsin clerks changed rules, and Wisconsin has no provision to let people vote early in person, only absentee, and that there were parks just letting people vote with no ID. Pennsylvania allowed people to vote without ID and with no postmark on the ballot, and that violates Act 77. And then he mentions the Wisconsin court ruled 4-3. He doesn't actually say what they ruled or what the case was. So look at all of this different stuff we now have to deal with in order to simply say, hey, Trump lost, and that's it. On Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Nevada, he says, well, there were problems, and he just lists them. But he doesn't really explain what the problems were. In 2020, the results were Biden 303 and Trump 235. If you flip all three of those states, Trump gets the 270 votes he needs. But that's if you flip all three. Let's say Sean Spicer is right, but about two of those three states, and what he's right about actually means that Trump won two of those three states. Biden still wins the election in that case. So even at its face, he's throwing out three states as if Trump probably won them, just to demonstrate that in one of those, Trump actually won, would be a Herculean effort for which there's no evidence. But if you only are able to successfully demonstrate Trump really won two of those three, Biden still wins that election. So that's a real red herring. Second, rules changed leading up to the election. Some states did change election procedures without legislation, but that's no big deal. We've studied this already. I already told you, Rebecca Green, election law professor at College of William and Mary, said, it's often the case that election statutes have gaps that don't account for particular situations like the pandemic. So just because a decision was made not from the legislature, it was made by the governor's office or a public health board or whatever, that's really not a big deal. Spicer asserts that it happened as if that's a problem. It's not actually a problem. It's common. Many states also changed election rules because of the pandemic. Blue states and red states did it. States that Trump won did it, and states Biden won did it. And big shocker, these Republicans only ever talk about the fact that states Biden won did it. North Dakota changed rules due to the pandemic, not through the legislature leading up to the election. So did Arkansas. So did Texas. They all made state changes in that way. Trump won those. They don't make a peep about those. Then Spicer mentions a 2019 Pennsylvania law signed by Governor Wolf, which says ballots have to be in by 8 p.m. It's true that Pennsylvania law did require ballots to be in by 8 p.m. on Election Day. But before the 2020 election, the state Supreme Court of Pennsylvania extended the deadline so ballots could be received by mail until 5 p.m. on the Friday of election week, if they're either postmarked by Election Day or have a missing or illegible postmark. They did a new deadline. It was dealt with. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court dealt with that. Now, if Sean Spicer wants to argue the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is illegitimate in so doing, that's a different argument. But it's been dealt with in a legal way that is accepted as a valid way to change when absentee ballots can be received. Then Spicer says, well, how many votes were illegally cast? It's such a vague question, it's meaningless, because his definition of illegal might be it was received after 8 p.m. on Election Day in Pennsylvania. But as I told you, the state Supreme Court already dealt with that. So what does he really mean by illegal votes? Wisconsin, he says, had no provision to let people vote early in person, only absentee. Well, Wisconsin didn't used to permit early in-person voting, but then they decided to in 2021. They can do that. He says, well, the clerks decided. The clerks have the authority to decide that. They decided it legally and changed that rule. It's not actually a red flag the way he says. And then lastly, he mentions the Wisconsin court ruled 4-3, and he doesn't tell you what they ruled. Well, I looked into it. The conservative-led Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled 4-3 not to throw out 220,000 ballots that the Trump campaign wanted thrown out. Spicer mentions it. Look, the Wisconsin court ruled 4-3. Yeah, but what did they rule? It was a conservative majority Supreme Court which decided you can't just throw out these 220,000 ballots. So each of these things, when you analyze them, is really nothing. It's not a smoking gun. It's not a red flag. But if you watch the 2.5 minutes I played for you, it might seem like Bill Maher didn't really refute everything. And this is exactly the challenge that Sam Harris has recently talked about when asked, why aren't you debating more of these vaccine skeptics or ivermectin advocates or whatever? Because they show up and they go, wait a second, you didn't see the Bangladeshi study? Which showed what, you know, whatever. No, I didn't see it. Oof. Wow. And you think you know what's going on? The Bangladeshi study may be something. It may not be something. Really good example. Glad that it was posted to our subreddit. Donald Trump reemerged over the Halloween weekend after weeks of simply publishing unhinged statement after statement to his website in an interview with Fox News's Jeanine Pirro. Now, it was Halloween weekend. This interview that Trump gave was way scarier than any costume or any horror movie. That's for sure. So let's jump in. Trump saying just days before tomorrow's Virginia gubernatorial election, Trump arguing that his endorsement is worth a lot. He almost always wins, and he has endorsed Glenn Youngkin. Let's take a look at the clip.
If I endorse somebody, they win. I think I'm 148-2. That's a pretty good number.
You endorsed Youngkin.
And I did endorse Youngkin. And we're going to see. I hope it's not going to be 3. Okay? Do you understand that?
Yeah.
I did. I endorse him strongly. He's a good man.
Now, the funny thing about the Youngkin endorsement is that if Youngkin does ultimately win tomorrow, Trump is obviously going to say, hey, that's another win in my column. That's another one that I endorsed and who won. If Youngkin loses tomorrow, Youngkin has actually been distancing himself from Donald Trump for the last month or so. He appears to have calculated that Trump's involvement may not actually help him defeat Terry McAuliffe tomorrow. So if Youngkin loses, of course, Trump's going to say, you know, listen, I would have brought him a win, but Youngkin didn't embrace me. That's why it's really Youngkin's fault. So Trump's going to take advantage of tomorrow's results no matter what. But what are the actual numbers on the facts? Trump's record is not that good on endorsements. In the 2018 midterms, Trump endorsed 75 candidates and 55% of them won. So Trump's record in 2018 was 55 wins, 45% losses, 55% wins. And he's mostly endorsing incumbents. So it's actually not so great a record. And Ballotpedia looked at Trump's overall record during his entire presidency. They tracked 305 endorsements that Trump made. And Trump's record in 2020, for example, was that 77% of his endorsees won. Again, there is a bias to success because Trump mostly endorses incumbents and incumbency has a huge advantage. So it's really not that great of a record. Let's look at a little bit more of this interview that Trump gave Jeanine Pirro and just pick up a couple of just wacky things Trump says.
Okay, if there's one word that could sum up the Biden administration, it would be crisis. There's the energy crisis, the supply chain crisis, the COVID crisis. If you look back on the last 10 months of the Biden administration, what grade would you give them?
Well, it's probably the worst presidency in history. I can't imagine. I used to say Jimmy Carter. Not a big fan of Bush getting us into the Middle East, to be honest with you. I think this is, though, the worst in the history of our country. If you look at Afghanistan and that horrible thing that happened to our nation with these young people being killed, and by the way, so badly injured. We have over 20, no arm.
So remember, when asked, Donald Trump has not been able to articulate anything he would have done differently in Afghanistan. Let's go to, I believe this is a discussion of gas prices, and this is very interesting because it's an opportunity for Trump to be honest, but he's not. Take a look.
Average American family spending an extra $175 a month. Gas prices are up to $7 in California, $5 in New York. Yeah. We can't afford these people. And Joe Biden, when he was asked about gas prices, what he's going to do about it, he says, I don't see anything that's going to significantly reduce gas prices in
Incredible.
The near future.
Incredible.
He doesn't know.
He doesn't have any idea. Look, one of the things I was most proud about, our country became energy independent.
Not
true.
We didn't
need the Middle East. We didn't need Russia. We didn't need anybody. We had our own. We had more than them. We were number one by far over Saudi Arabia and you know this, and Russia. Number one by far. I had the pipelines going, Keystone XL pipeline. Amazingly, I ended the Russian pipeline. I was not good to Russia. I got along well with Russia. I got along well with Putin. But they weren't happy with Trump, I can tell you that. Mm-hmm. But Biden opened up this big, massive pipeline all over Europe, but he closed down the XL. And I don't have to say, because you heard it 1,000 times.
Yeah.
More importantly, we're energy independent no longer. I was so proud of that. First time really in history.
Understand that there has been no appreciable change in the energy supply configuration of the United States in the 10 months Joe Biden has been president. I mean, it's just Trump cites nothing. It just hasn't happened. It's imaginary.
You know, they say 75 years, but I don't believe we were ever energy independent.
It was
and
big.
We were energy independent. We were doing so much. The prices, it was $1.87 a gallon. Okay. If you look at, the numbers.
They're crazy.
And now, yesterday, they had in a certain section of California, $7.70. It's always the lead.
Yeah.
It's going to follow, and it's going to go a lot higher than that. And Biden sent people to go see Russia, Saudi Arabia, and other members of OPEC that we need help because we don't have enough. Now, when you talk about inflation, the biggest factor.
So it would be really, I actually think Joe Biden should be applauded for what he said during the town hall. He said, As a president, the one thing I can do probably only drops gas 30 cents. That is refreshingly honest, because when it's convenient, presidents love to pretend that they really have control over gas prices. We're talking about global markets. We're talking about supply chains that move really slowly. Now, in terms of Trump claiming gas was super cheap, he mentioned $1.87 a gallon. For the 4 years that Trump was in office, gas prices were under $2 a gallon for only 2 months, April and May of 2020. And that's because demand went to zero because of the start of the pandemic. And it was where people were traveling as little as we've seen them travel, drive around, work from home started, etc. It would be really refreshing if more presidents said, hey, you know what? I know this is a popular political football, but as presidents, we have very little control over gas prices. We have the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which on a medium-term basis could reduce prices a little, but this is really much bigger than us. But of course, Trump doesn't do that. Horrifying disinformation. If you have the stomach for it, check out the entire interview. It's available on foxnews.com. We're going to leave it there. Send me your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at dpacman. Remember that you can support our show and the work we do and get some really cool extras in so doing by signing up for a membership at joinpacman.com. You'll get the daily bonus show as well as commercial-free audio and video streams of the show. So many great things, including priority access to our viewer town halls, one of which we had a couple of weeks ago. We've got another one scheduled for soon. I'll announce the date once I have it, but it'll be probably in the next month or 5 weeks or so. You know, last week, or maybe it was the week before, I told you about a report that looked at how COVID denialism and COVID conspiracy delusions have been a great feeder into anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and all of the different overlaps that exist about shadow government both being controlled by Jews and wanting everybody injected with tracking devices or, you know, whatever the case may be. The point is, this report found how online COVID denialism and COVID conspiracies are very much interlaced with anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and white supremacy, white nationalism, etc. Now, anytime there's a report, it can be sort of abstract, and we might not see or understand in practice the way that this comes together. I have an example for you that was sent to me by a few viewers today. We're going to be looking at video here of from a few days ago. I believe this was Wednesday or Thursday of last week. This is the Chandler Governing Board study session and regular business meeting. And there is a woman who is going to speak, and you're going to listen to her momentarily. And it is really the perfect storm. It's an amalgam of anti-vax, anti-mask, anti-critical race theory, delusions, ignorance, shadow government conspiracism, and of course, she ties it all together in a nice little bow and says, it's all the Jews, folks. It's really all the Jews. So one race is responsible. The Jews are making the vaccines. The Jews control the shadow government. The Jews control the pharmaceutical companies. And this is what we're talking about when we say these are the ways that these things come together. It may be one of the most insane clips I've seen since this all started. Let's jump right into it. Warning, you know, if you don't want kids to see this, I would understand getting them out of the room. Let's listen.
My name is Melanie Rettler. I'm a veterinarian. I was a former teacher in Phoenix Union High School District. I'm a cloning expert with 35 years experience, and I was a consultant to the CDC. I've owned a pharmacy.
So do we know if any of those things are true? She was a vet. She was a teacher. She's an expert on cloning. She was a consultant to the CDC, presumably, I don't know, on something related to veterinary stuff, and she owned a pharmacy. Did she own a human pharmacy or a veterinary pharmacy? We don't know if any of it's true.
I want to tell you that this vaccine, this COVID vaccine, is a deadly poison. That's it. I'm just going to tell you that. Everybody that takes it is damaging their immune system, and they're talking about this being given to children now. It's going to destroy them.
Now, it's already been tested on tens of thousands of kids in clinical trials, and the kids are fine.
You need to do more research on it. I'm an expert on it, and I'm telling you, that's what it's doing.
What's also interesting is that all of the expertise she claims to have, which includes being a veterinarian, consultant to the CDC, pharmacy owner, teacher, expert on cloning, none of that relates to vaccines. You would imagine that she would have mentioned in that litany of expertise that she's also an expert on vaccines. She didn't.
All right. The next thing is, the next topic is the CRT. I agree with what both of these people said. But you know what? If you want to talk about racism, if you want to bring it in, then let's bring it in. Let's get to the bottom of it. You're talking about white supremacy. Okay. Let's get to the very bottom of it. Every one of these things, the deep state, the cabal, the swamp, the elite, you can't mention it, but I will. There is one race that owns all the pharmaceutical companies, and these vaccines aren't safe, they aren't effective, and they aren't free. You know that you're paying for it through the increase in gas prices, the increase in food prices. You're paying for this, and it's being taken from your money and given to these pharmaceutical companies. And if you want to bring race into this, it's the Jews.
So a smattering of applause there as she ties together all of these different things, inflation, gas prices, critical race theory, the vaccines through the pharmaceutical companies, the shadow government, it's all the Jews, according to this woman. This is the prototypical example of how this stuff works, and it just works so well for them. It feels so cohesive and coherent and logical. This is what we were talking about last week with the report about how this COVID stuff feeds right into the anti-Semitism. And again, you know, the framing of you're not allowed to say it, but I'm going to. The same group is in control of all this stuff, the shadow government and the gas prices. I guess the Jews own the gas stations is what she's saying, and the various products. Maybe the most insane clip I've seen since all of this started. Hey, this is starting to now become very, very obvious in terms of the concern, the panic that Donald Trump has about the truth getting out as to what he was up to and who he was meeting with in the days leading up to the Trump riots. We've known now for a little while that Donald Trump is doing everything he can to get Joe Biden to assert executive privilege over documents related to his actions leading up to the Trump riots. And so far, Joe Biden has said he's not going to do that. We now have learned, thanks to some really great reporting from CNN crime and justice reporter Caitlin Polance, that Donald Trump is acting desperately to hide his daily schedule in the days leading up to the January 6th riot. Why would he want to do that? Well, we can infer that if it became known what he was up to and who he was meeting with, there would be a lot of overlap with people that played roles in ginning up and inciting the January 6th riots, maybe even worse. So let's go first to this is based on reporting by Caitlin Polance, which we'll get to. CNN reporter Caitlin Collins tweeted about this, saying, quote, "Major news overnight, per a sworn declaration from the National Archives, Trump is trying to keep more than 700 pages of files out of the hands of the January 6th committee, including 30 pages of his daily schedule, visitor logs, and call records for Trump-Pence," Caitlin Polance reports. "This includes documents from Trump's top aides, including three handwritten notes from Mark Meadows, proposed talking points for Kayleigh McEnany, files from Stephen Miller and Deputy Counsel Pat Philbin, the White House daily diary, and drafts of remarks regarding the National Archives," says Trump wants to assert executive. Oh, sorry, for remarks regarding January 6th. "The National Archives says Trump wants to assert privilege over a handwritten note from former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows' files listing potential or scheduled briefings and telephone calls concerning the January 6th certification and other election issues. Trump doesn't want it to be known who he was talking to about how to block the certification on January 6th. And we have, you know, some pretty sensible guesses as to why. The report from CNN's Caitlin Polance, worth reading in full. Specifics about former President Trump's efforts to keep secret the support from his White House for overturning his loss of the 2020 election were revealed in late-night court filings detailing more than 700 pages of handwritten notes, draft documents, and daily logs related to January 6th. This is for the first time, a sworn declaration of what Trump wants to keep secret. The records show Trump wants to keep secret include handwritten memos from his chief of staff, call logs of Trump and Pence and White House visitor records, additional court records revealed early Saturday morning. Trump's court case is a crucial and potentially historic legal fight over the authority of a former president to protect his term in office, the House's subpoena power, and the reach of executive privilege. But it's not only that. It's also an attempt for us not to know the degree to which Donald Trump was involved in planning and had foreknowledge of what ultimately took place on January 6th, the Trump riots. What would his schedule expose? Well, it's speculation at this point because we only know the gist of what he wants to cover up, not the content, because so far it's not been made public. But maybe there were too many meetings with people involved or suspected to be involved in the Trump riots. Maybe Trump actually had phone calls with some of the people that organized and carried out violence. We just don't know. And I'm conceding that this is speculation, but this is not the behavior of an innocent person. Now, hold on a second. hold on a second. I'm not saying Trump doesn't deserve due process. I'm not saying anything about that. People are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. And it doesn't mean that Trump is guilty. So everybody relax. I know that there's a contingent where every time I say this is not the behavior of an innocent person, someone writes and says, David, that ignores due process. People aren't guilty in the U.S. until proven innocent. This isn't a court of law. This is my show. And it is my opinion, colloquially, that this is not the behavior of an innocent person. That doesn't mean he's guilty of anything in a criminal trial. It's not what I'm saying. He's not even been charged. The one other thought about this, Trump seems to sort of be telling the January 6th committee exactly where to look for the most relevant evidence about his behavior by making it clear what it is he doesn't want revealed. Last thing, all of this relates to the release of these documents to the January 6th committee. If they are released to the January 6th committee, there is no guarantee that they will actually be made public to us. They may leak, of course. That's always a risk. But this is not about making these documents public. This is about making them available to the January 6th committee. What do you believe is in Trump's schedule and call logs that he wants to cover up? Let me know. We'll have more on this on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. So as we continue to wait for and wonder, is Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz going to be charged for possibly child sex trafficking and or other crimes? The investigation is ongoing. Matt Gaetz has retained lawyers expert in defending against sex crimes. As we wonder about that, his behavior continues to become more and more outrageous. And over the weekend, Matt Gaetz actually, I guess you could call it joking. I'm not really sure. Matt Gaetz joked about blowing up Capitol metal detectors with explosives. This, of course, relates to the metal detectors that were installed at the Capitol, at least in part because it was believed that some Republican members of Congress, including Lauren Boebert, maybe others, Madison Cawthorn has talked about being armed, being protected, bringing weapons onto the House floor. So we're going to go through this piece by piece. Mediaite article says, while campaigning for a Republican congressional candidate in Central Florida on Saturday, Congressman Matt Gaetz complained about the metal detectors in the Capitol, lying about why they were installed and going so far as to joke about blowing them up with explosives. The Florida congressman was in Lake County to campaign for Florida State Rep. Anthony Sabatini, who is running for Congress in 2022 and shares Gaetz's support for former President Donald Trump. Gaetz mentioned Congresswoman Lauren Boebert's objection to the metal detectors that were installed in the Capitol complex shortly after the Trump riots. Multiple Republican lawmakers loudly complained about the metal detectors, claiming they were a violation of their constitutional rights. They weren't. And Boebert was among those who attempted to circumvent the screening by walking around the metal detectors or refusing to allow her bag to be searched. All right, so let's take a look at the first clip here. Here is Matt Gaetz talking about blowing up the metal detectors in the House with either Tannerite or C4 explosive.
My friend Lauren Boebert from Colorado, they put in metal detectors on the floor of the House because as like a 5-foot-nothing woman, she carries a firearm for her personal protection. So, oh, they got triggered by that. I said, man, is it Tannerite or C4 we want to put in those metal detectors when we blow them up and we take them to charity?
Yeah.
Now, in all seriousness, this is the exact type of thing that causes stochastic violence, if not stochastic terror. Aside from whether it's even appropriate, absent any real world implications, for a sitting member of Congress to be joking about, or maybe not joking, talking about blowing up the chamber in which he works and votes and in which legislative duties are carried out, whether you can say that's fine or it's not fine or whatever. If you have an understanding, if you recognize and realize the degree to which disproportionately the types of people that follow someone like Matt Gaetz are folks who would be willing to do violence in real life to solve political issues, you start to realize this could actually encourage someone to go and to try to set off a bomb at the House. Now, would they get into where the metal detectors are? Maybe not, but that's not really a defense. this is, we've talked about stochastic terror. Given a large enough audience, if you hammer on and hammer on and hammer on an idea and radicalize people against a person or institution, it starts to become statistically likely that someone, it wouldn't be predictable exactly who, but that, whoa, sorry for hitting my mic, that someone is going to go out and actually act on that. Now, as a reminder, we recently had more context to this. Lauren Boebert was recently interviewed by cultural critic and arbiter of ideas, Dave Rubin. And Lauren Boebert sort of smiled and laughed and kind of took credit, supposedly, for the metal detectors even being there. Remember this from last week?
Nancy Pelosi has called me the enemy within. We have metal detectors outside of the House chambers because of me. And yeah. So it seems.
So they now are ridiculing what are actions that had to be taken because members of Congress posed a risk in terms of the weapons they were trying to bring in. As I said last week, it's not something to be proud about that your place of work had to put in metal detectors because of your actions. It's not something that I would be humiliated if that were the case. Also from the same very strange appearance here, Matt Gaetz says he thinks Democrats are going to see how many Republican votes are there, and then they will illegally create Democratic votes to counter that, sort of like as a one-to-one thing, completely baseless, no evidence of this. Take a look at Matt Gaetz's suggestion.
I really think they, like in Fulton County, Georgia, I think they wait and they see how many votes the Republicans got in the other parts of the state, and then that's how many they need to like will into existence.
So that's a completely unfalsifiable claim. You can always look at election results and say, oh, Democrats won by 1,000. Democrats actually really lost by 1,000, but they checked how many Republican votes they were, and then they created 2,000 Democratic votes to take a 1,000 vote lead. Completely unfalsifiable, hasn't happened, no evidence that it's happened, no evidence that Democrats have attempted it, just more poisoning the well. That type of thing only works on ignorant voters. There's no evidence that that's done, and it would be completely unfalsifiable. Just look, you can look at any election result, and in fact, they're doing it. Mike Pillow does it, and these people do it. They say, no. Trump really won Wisconsin by 200,000. Really, where's the evidence? Well, they won't give us the evidence. Oh, okay. Well, then, so how will we? He really won. You can't falsify a lot of these things, and that's what makes them great fodder for low information voters. All right, this next story, at first, I wasn't going to cover it at all. The story is that at an Atlanta Braves game over the weekend at the World Series, Donald Trump participated in the tomahawk chop. Now, the tomahawk chop is this sort of ritual or routine, or, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, that is done at the Atlanta Braves baseball games. It also has been done elsewhere. The Exeter Chiefs use the tomahawk chop, but it's quite well known for the Atlanta Braves. And the idea is that it's sort of a chopping motion done with your hand as if you're holding an axe. It's a reference to scalping by Native Americans. And what's problematic about it, you know, every time, sometimes it's like people play really dumb. They go, what's xenophobic, or I don't know whether the right word is xenophobic or racist or whatever, but you're essentially portraying as savages Native American peoples in the United States. And of course, the more we learn about Native populations, the more we learn that there was quite a lot here. They had complex societies. They were developing technology. You know, it's just ahistorical, but it's also just really kind of vile. And the story that first started floating around was, oh, Trump does the tomahawk chop. And it's like, yeah, whatever. Trump's an idiot. I'm not going to cover it. But then the storyline became that during that, Melania Trump appears to turn away and look disgusted and kind of roll her eyes at Trump as all of this is going on. And it's again this whole thing of, oh, Melania's being held captive, Melania really hates Trump, and all of this sort of thing. For me, the real story is that they were both there doing the tomahawk chop. So let's start with the first video. This is the tomahawk chop taking place, and both Melania and Trump are doing it. If you can't see it, you're not missing that much. It's Trump and Melania doing the tomahawk chop. Take a look.
Oh!
Okay. So it's cringy. It's just gross. Like it, ugh, it's just, what the hell is the former president doing? It's crazy that this is even done. That's for me, the real story, that Trump participated in that. That was a blip. But then the big story became this moment that I'm playing for you here on repeat, where Melania smiles, and this was either, you know, right before, right after the tomahawk chop. And she then just kind of grimaces and rolls her eyes and turns away. And it's, again, this whole thing of Melania doesn't like Donald Trump. Is she safe? Is she being held hostage? If she's really that disgusted with Trump, she certainly hasn't shown disgust with the specific ideas and xenophobia and backwards thinking that Trump promulgated and emulated during his presidency. She would show up and talk about a lot of the same things that Donald Trump did when in her rare public appearances. There would be some occasional little apparent disagreement. But for me, the story here is not, oh, Melania's disgusted again and maybe she hates Trump. Maybe she is and maybe that's true, but she's not acted on it in any real way. For me, the real story is the fact that the president and the former president and the former first lady are doing the tomahawk chop at a baseball game, which is just a horrible, horrible, again, just like a portrayal of unilateral savagery from the very native populations that were decimated by the arriving settlers of what is now the United States. So it's like the prototypical example of the real story being missed, as what was happening was horrifying. Just from Yahoo News, Melania Trump attended a World Series baseball game. Cameras showed her quick pivot from smiling with her husband to turning away and rolling her eyes. Twitter also caught the moment, igniting discussion on the platform. Melania Trump strikes again. It's pretty pathetic. Her strikes have been superficial in nature and meaningless in substance. And that's really the story here. So if you disagree, if you think that that her reaction really is the big story versus the fact that they were both participating in the tomahawk chop, let me know. Let me know. I'm open to being convinced, but for me, the real story is the tomahawk chop. So last week we had a big discussion across multiple days about, should progressives just now at this point work to kill the spending and infrastructure bill that's been completely gutted? I gave you a list last week of 5-6 major pieces of the proposals that had been floating around that are believed to be completely dead in the water. And I said, at this point, I'm okay with progressives saying kill it. I often say if it does some good, then it should be supported because it's a step in the right direction. It will help some people, and any opportunity to help people should be taken. I started to go in the direction last week of there's so little here that this will serve as a victory for centrist Democrats by saying we don't have to do anything progressives want. It will serve as a victory for Republicans for saying the more we obstruct, the less they're going to get, even if we're not in control. And it's nothing for progressives. We've got a voicemail related to killing the bill, which I'm going to play for you in a little bit. One bit of news is that Bernie Sanders has not given up. Senator Bernie Sanders appeared on CNN yesterday and made it very clear that he's still pushing at least to get lower drug prices into the bill. Now, if he was able to do that, is lower drug prices, price controls on medications and prescriptions, would that be enough to say, well, okay, just for that alone, progressives should support it? We'll get to that in a second. Let's first listen to some of this interview he gave.
You have said there are major gaps in this plan. Several of your priorities, paid leave, dental and vision for Medicare, giving the government power to negotiate lower prescription drug prices for seniors, that's not in the deal. You saw that House progressives endorsed the compromise. Do you?
Well, it's not in the bill yet. But what I can tell you, Dana, we are working right now. I spent all of yesterday on the telephone. Look, we are paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. The pharmaceutical industry has spent hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to make certain that Americans pay 10 times more for some drugs than the Canadians or the Mexicans do.
True.
That fight continues. And the fight to expand Medicare. Look, poll after poll shows that the American people understand it is not acceptable that elderly people have teeth in their mouth that are rotting. They can't digest their food. They don't have the vision that they need in order to read a newspaper. So we are continuing that effort.
So
and
can I
it
just
pains me very much I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just want to just make sure that I understand what you're saying. You're saying you're continuing that effort. You want to still add it before the House votes? You want to add it to the bill that the
Absolutely.
House...
Look, we're working, as everybody should know, we're on two separate bills. You got a bipartisan infrastructure bill, which will finally begin to address the reality that our roads and our bridges and our water systems are crumbling. That's one bill. But we want to move both bills in tandem. And the second bill, the bill that deals with the needs of the working class of this country in terms of childcare, in terms of pre-K, that deals with the existential threat of climate, that bill is still being worked on literally today. It will be worked on tomorrow. I believe we're making some progress in making it even stronger than it is.
If you don't succeed in that progress, will you support the framework
right.
as it currently stands?
Good question.
What the White House released at the end of the week?
Well, all I will tell you is we have a very, very strong bill. And it deals with the fact that we are going to start paying attention to the needs of working parents, continue that $300. We're going to build affordable housing. We're going to make sure that elderly people and people with disabilities can stay at home rather than be forced
to. So Bernie goes into talk, you know, these are talking points that we've heard before. But so the fundamental question ultimately gets to, let's say Bernie and other Democrats get lower prescription drug price provisions into the bill, then should progressives support it? In my mind, that actually would be enough to say support the bill. And it wouldn't change the fact that it would still be missing and lacking so many things that were talked about early. A tax that target, you know, between these two bills, tax that targets the very, very richest billionaires, paid leave, child care, you know, Medicare expansion, so many things that I am in favor of and that are good and that are necessary and that should be in there. All of those things would still be gone. But the degree to which the American people are getting screwed when it comes to prescription drug costs, and it's so popular to talk about lowering prescription drug costs, both Democrats and Republicans talk about it all the time. Trump talked about it. He didn't do it. But the mechanisms through which they would do it, of course, differ. There's no question about that. It actually would be so materially useful to so many people, particularly seniors, the way that Bernie Sanders is talking about because of how Medicare works. That, again, I'm talking pragmatically. I know the optics are terrible, but that is so good for so many people that I would probably say, don't kill the bill. Get the bill done if that's in there. Now, how likely that is to happen and how much of this is Bernie either posturing or trying to put public pressure on colleagues and other, we just don't know. These negotiations are happening constantly between different parties. And this is why my coverage of this has basically been, listen, the entire process is a grandstanding quagmire. There's a lot of this that is just the worst of politics and worst of the DC Beltway. It doesn't relate to people who are just trying to afford gas, trying to afford food, trying to afford medication. It doesn't connect. It's so abstract and idealized in some way by those who think, oh, big negotiate. It's a lot of BS that's going on. And I get all of that. But if there's really going to be something actually done, and if you trust Bernie, if you're a Bernie supporter, if you believe Bernie does the right things or tries to, then you would imagine that if he gets that into the bill, it's going to be materially substantive. I think I'm probably back on and say, just pass it and get it done. And then let's move on and try to do more and do the next iteration. If you disagree with me on the value of prescription drug price controls as reason alone to support the bill, I want to hear from you. Reasonable people can disagree, but it seems like an important thing to me. A White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, has tested positive for COVID. And of course, the question was, well, when was she with Joe Biden and what's going on? And it actually turns out that she hasn't been around Joe Biden for a little bit and is not on Joe Biden's current trip to Europe, apparently because many in her family had tested positive. So here's the report from CNN. Psaki tests positive for COVID, last saw Biden Tuesday. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, who dropped off President Joe Biden's international trip shortly before he departed, has tested positive for coronavirus after members of her household did. Psaki said she last saw Biden Tuesday outside while masked before the president departed for Rome for the Group of 20 summit and that she tested negative several times in between. Psaki said she was disclosing the positive test result, quote, out of an abundance of transparency, adding she experienced mild symptoms and is working remotely. It's unlikely Psaki could have infected Biden with COVID-19, several physicians told CNN Sunday. Based on the timeline of Ms. Psaki's testing negative for multiple days following her last encounter with Biden, which was also outside and masked, therefore very low risk in and of itself, Dr. Leanna Wen, a CNN medical analyst and former Baltimore City Health Commissioner, said in an email. The White House announced Thursday Psaki would no longer join Biden on his trip abroad for the at least the first few days, citing a family emergency. White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre instead traveled with the president. Jen Psaki put out a statement about this, where she said on Wednesday, in coordination with senior leadership at the White House and the medical team, I made the decision not to travel with the on the foreign trip with the president due to a family emergency, which was members of my household testing positive for COVID-19. Since then, I have quarantined and tested negative via PCR for COVID on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. However, today I tested positive for COVID. While I have not had close contact in person with the president or senior members of the White House staff since Wednesday and tested negative for 4 days after that last contact, I am disclosing today's positive test out of an abundance of transparency. I last saw the president on Tuesday when we sat outside more than 6 feet apart and wore masks. Thanks to the vaccine, I have only experienced mild symptoms, which has enabled me to continue working from home. I plan to return to work in person at the conclusion of the 10-day quarantine following a negative rapid test, which is an additional White House requirement beyond CDC guidance, taken out of an abundance of caution. So she's vaccinated, so is Joe Biden. Outside, masks, two vaccinated people, transmission risk is almost zero. I say not, I don't say zero because strange things happen when you have bell curve distributions of things and unexplainable things happen. Incredibly unlikely that Joe Biden would get COVID in this case. She correctly assesses her risk is lower and her risk of a serious case is lower because she's vaccinated. That's true. Now, there are people, opportunists and just ignorant people, who will see this and once again, much like with the death of Colin Powell, say this is proof that the vaccines don't work. And of course, any one anecdote doesn't tell us much about, at a population level, what does and doesn't work about vaccines. The fact that Colin Powell died despite being vaccinated, given that he was 84 and immunocompromised in more than one way, doesn't really tell us anything about the effect at a population level of vaccination. In much the same way, when Jen Psaki says, thanks to the vaccine, I have mild symptoms, that's not really an empirical statement. Statistically speaking, she's likely to have fewer symptoms thanks to being vaccinated. Any individual, though, it's harder to make such a statement, but her general assessment is correct. By being vaccinated, she's at lower risk for a serious case. And unfortunately, there are many people who either don't understand the science or don't want to understand it because they have preconceived notions or desires about what they believe the vaccine to do, where they will say, what's the point of getting vaccinated? Psaki was vaccinated and she got it. Well, she's working at home. And she seems to feel mostly okay. So that's the latest. Very unlikely that Joe Biden could have received the virus or that she would have spread the virus to Joe Biden in the situation that was described, particularly when she continued testing negative for several days. We have a voicemail number, and that number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a viewer's opinion about whether it's time for progressives to just kill the bill because it's had so much gutted. This is the spending and infrastructure bills that Bernie Sanders discussed earlier in today's program.
Hey, David, I just finished listening to your segment about the now gutted infrastructure bill and how more and more is getting pulled out to appease Joe Manchin and
others.
I'm with you. I'm at the point where I think that progressives just need to say, no, there's nothing in here for us. We don't want it.
Mm.
Better than that, though, I think what should be done, if possible, I don't know if it is, but bring it to a vote. Bring it to the floor and force Manchin and force Sinema to vote no on it. And then that way there's no denying where they are, where anyone else is on their position regarding this bill and regarding help for the American people who pay their salaries.
Yeah, I'm not against eventually just get a vote. And if they really aren't going to go anywhere, get them on record voting against it. I'm fine with that. As I said, I was fine with it during the entire force the vote on Medicare thing, that Medicare for All, that AOC. And I'm not against getting people on record. I'm more about trying to actually achieve something. So I don't need to immediately force a vote right now. If there's a chance that, like, for example, as Bernie Sanders said, and we played the clip earlier, if he is still working on getting prescription drug cost controls in the bill, I'd rather wait a little longer and actually get that in the bill and pass it, because that's better for more people. Ultimately, though, I do think that there has to be some kind of limit. And if we get to that limit and progressives are better served by just killing the bill, at a certain point, you got to just vote and get Joe Manchin to vote no, and get Kirsten Sinema to vote no, and get him on record. I'm not against that when the time comes. It actually does seem that at least Bernie Sanders believes some substantive progress could be made and some major things could be put in the bill. We have a great bonus show for you today. We're going to talk about this just completely botched revelation or announcement from Facebook that they are changing its company name to Meta. A lot of people misunderstanding, thinking Facebook, the app, is now called Meta. No, this is a corporate change. Google is now Alphabet, and it's still Google.com. Everything's still called Google, Google Nest, Google Home, etc. We will talk about a strawberry Pop-Tart case that is one of 400 lawsuits that a lawyer has filed. And when we talk about frivolous, we've got to talk about this, and I think it'll be an interesting discussion. And then also outrage over a Southwest Airlines pilot saying, "Let's go, Brandon," which is the new, it's a code for F Joe Biden that comes from a sort of confusion during a car race that took place. We'll explain it all, but a Southwest Airlines pilot essentially saying F Joe Biden during his pre-flight announcement to passengers, audible gasps were heard in the cabin and demands for the pilot to be fired. He should be fired. He should be fired. Political statements, I believe, are against company policy for pilots for basically every airline. So we will talk about that and much more when producer Pat joins me on today's bonus show. Get instant access by signing up at
We at WRCT Pittsburgh do not condone the illegal duplication of copyrighted material. But if you happen to own all the tracks we played and would like a copy of them, just FTP to FTP.
Due to a request by computing services, the remainder of this announcement cannot
be. Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona, but when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio, and Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
Hey, this is Ben Foles, and you're listening to WRCT. It's 2 for Tuesday, 3 for Thursday, Ladies Night Wet T-Shirt Contest on 88.3 FM, biatch.
Thank you.
This is Brad Yoder, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey there, this is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Is Mark G of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
WRCT Insane from Way Out.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT. FM. Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. Hi, we're the Deliverance Strangers, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT, this is the place that sets the pace for Pittsburgh.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
Hello, I'm Meg Lee Chin, and when I'm in town, I like to listen to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, home of... Oh, crap. We're not really home of anything, are we?
Hi, you're listening to...
WRCT.
Pittsburgh. CMU. This is Sue Garner.
And Rick Brown.
Have some barbecue sauce.
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Hi, this is Martin Atkins from Pigface, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Or I'm from Creationist Crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
Things get brighter day by day when you listen to the Big W. Life is lighter in every way when you listen to the Big W. So laugh it up and let yourself go with King Size Radio. The Big WRCT. Radio Carnegie Tech.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're listening in at your house, are you listening in at your car? If you want to hear good music, you don't have to go far. 88.3 is the magic number. WRCT in at the Pittsburgh area. Who say so? I say so. Who is me? Maka.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is the challenge of our collective lifetimes, the existential threat to human existence as we know it. And every day we delay, the cost of inaction increases. So let this be the moment that we answer history's call here in Glasgow.
At the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, President Biden vows to take action to address the climate emergency. But at home, his climate agenda has been dealt another setback, as Senator Joe Manchin says he's not yet ready to support Biden's slim down, build back better plan. We'll speak to Bill McKibben, the co-founder of 350.org, and Tom Goldtooth, head of the Indigenous Environmental Network. They're both in Glasgow. Then to a 23-year-old climate activist from Samoa.
Pacific youth have rallied behind the cry, "We are not drowning, we are fighting." This is our warrior cry to the world. We are not drowning, we are fighting.
We're broadcasting from Glasgow and New York. Then we look at Monday's Supreme Court oral arguments on the constitutionality of Texas's near total ban on abortions. We'll speak with the legendary lawyer Catherine Kitty Colbert, who argued the 1992 landmark Supreme Court case credited with saving Roe v. Wade. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 120 world leaders gathered in Glasgow, Scotland, Monday for the opening of a crucial United Nations climate summit whose outcome could determine the future habitability of the planet. The COP26 Climate Change Conference, as it's officially called, opened with this dire warning from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Enough of brutalizing biodiversity. Enough of killing ourselves with carbon. Enough of treating nature like a toilet. Enough of burning and drilling and mining our way deeper. We are digging our own graves.
As COP26 got underway, leaders from over 100 countries pledged to end and reverse deforestation by 2030. India also unveiled its plan to reduce carbon emissions to net zero, but only by 2070. And the United States is announcing a new plan today to reduce methane emissions. Speaking to the assembled leaders, President Joe Biden apologized for former President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. Biden said the U.S. and other nations who've contributed the most to the climate crisis have overwhelming obligations to help poorer countries contend with the climate emergency. Biden's comments came just days after he called on OPEC to increase oil production to lower fuel costs. Thousands of protesters have assembled outside the climate summit, demanding meaningful action to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. This is 19-year-old Mexican climate activist Maria Reyes.
My message for global world leaders is that they cannot have a climate negotiation without the people most impacted by the climate crisis present. If we allow them to do that, COP26 is going to be a rich people's conversation. And rich people are not most affected by the climate crisis. We are.
After headlines, we'll go to the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow for the latest. President Biden's domestic agenda was dealt a serious blow Monday when conservative Democratic Senator Joe Manchin refused to commit to supporting the pared-down Build Back Better Act, the 10-year, $1.75 trillion program to mitigate the climate crisis.